Morning. I'm so thankful for the ministry teams that we have here at Wasatch Hills Church. My wife has a condition because of her spinal cord injury that is hard to sort out sometimes. She gets to the end of a day and starts feeling feverish and starts feeling like she's coming down with something. And sometimes it takes us a little while to sort out what's actually going on. Usually it's that the fever is the only symptom, and that was kind of the case with her last night. More of a neurological thing having to do with her spinal cord injury than with any infection or anything like that. And so we appreciate your prayers, but we also I'm very grateful for some people that you wouldn't have even known were working late into the hours last night to cover some bases for Becky, because she wasn't sure she was going to be able to be here today. And that was Alicia and Dave, and emails going back and forth planning this song service that we just experienced and enjoyed. And I just give you a behind-the-scenes glimpse, because they pulled it off so smoothly you would have never noticed. But I want you to know, myself in the late hours last night, as I saw those emails going back and forth, I was so grateful for their servant hearts that were willing to step in at a moment's notice and bring a song service to us here at Wasatch Hills. I'm grateful for that. This message today entitled Two Ways to Pray, and there's kind of a hidden double meaning in that title, because we're going to talk about two ways to pray, and then we're going to talk about two ways to pray in one of those two ways. Okay, confusing? Yeah. Don't worry, I'll try to help make it a little bit more clear. One of the ways to pray we talked about last week, and that was apocalyptic prayer. Prayers in that moment of disaster, when the very worst happens, and suddenly we find ourselves realizing that while we may not be the one doing CPR on someone whose heart has stopped beating on the field, we can all gather around and we can pray in that instant and in that moment of tragedy. One thing that I didn't share last week that I actually meant to share, but in all the excitement I forgot to share with you, is that while these people were knelt around Damar Hamlin and CPR was being administered on him, there were other people worried about other things, believe it or not. I mean, how could you be worried about anything else than a man who's dying on the field? But there are some people whose jobs are to worry about other things, and that would be some executives in some offices, I think, in New York City, who had a decision to make during this pause on an ESPN televised Monday night football game, and the decision they had to make was, now what do we do? I mean, eventually, paramedics are going to come onto the field. This man's going to be put on a gurney, and assuming that there's any hope, he's going to be then taken by ambulance to a hospital and receive life-saving treatment. But then what? After all, this is the NFL. This is Monday Night Football. This is the greatest stage for professional football other than the Super Bowl. This is the big game. So what do we do? Do we just continue the game? 9 minutes into the game, we just continue the game? Only once in the history of professional football had this ever happened before. And it happened back in 1971 with 62 seconds left in the game. The man didn't have quite the same reason for his heart stopping as perhaps Damar did, but he had a heart disease issue where a blockage in his heart suddenly created a cardiac arrest, and he died on the field with 62 seconds left in the game. Now, there's a different scenario there, because if you have 62 seconds left in the game, all a team has to do is go out there, hike the ball, take a knee, let the clock run out, the game's over. But when you're 9 minutes into the game, you still have, over 45 minutes, 50 minutes of game still to play. You don't have seconds, you have minutes. You're not even three quarters of the way, you're not even one quarter of the way through the game. And so executives at the NFL headquarters had to make a decision, and that was, what do we do now? And they did the unthinkable. They canceled a football game during a football game. They not only canceled the football game during a football game, but they canceled the football game forever. This game will never resume. It will never take place. It has vanished from the record books. It's gone. And that seems like a crazy thing to do. I mean, why would you do something that you've never done before in this corporate world, in this corporate reality where there's so much money to be made and there's so many other things at stake? Well, because a man's life was on the line. But more than that, and I think it's best encapsulated in this quote that I'm about to share with you by a former NFL wide receiver. I don't know if any of you have ever played much football, but a athlete on a football team, especially a wide receiver, has a lot of things to think about. Their job oftentimes is to run down the field at blazing speed, arrive at the right place at exactly the right time to catch a ball that was thrown before they even turned around and looked back. And somehow they have to do all of this with another team that's trying their best to keep them from catching the ball and to cream them if they do. You know, that's his job. Well, this former NFL wide receiver, a man who didn't really have a very long career, but I think had an incredible bit of insight that Monday night when he was interviewed, said this. He said, "The decision to cancel the game was really obvious to me if you believe in the power of prayer. If you believe in the power of prayer, then you understand you cannot expect me to go figure out how to conquer cover two." That's a defensive strategy that a wide receiver would have to figure out how to conquer. "You can't expect me to go out to figure out how to conquer cover two when I have an opportunity to intercede with prayer for my friend during his most needed time of his life." Amen. "You can't expect me to play a game when something more important than a game is on the line. And hence the need for apocalyptic prayer." But not only apocalyptic prayer, prayer at a time of absolute necessity when life is on the line, but also intercessory prayer. The kind of prayer we do when somebody isn't able to pray for themselves. I have a theory on intercessory prayer, and my theory goes like this. Well, first of all, create the problem. The problem is that sometimes our intercessory prayers go like this. "Lord, Joe wants to do X, but we all know that what Joe wants to do is really bad for Joe, so please keep Joe from doing that thing," whatever it is, fill in the blank. Intercessory prayer can oftentimes kind of feel like I'm kind of imposing my will on this person I'm praying for. You know, I'm stepping in between them and God, and I'm asking God to make them do something that quite honestly they don't want to do. That's how intercessory prayer can feel. But I have a theory about intercessory prayer, and it works like this. Sometimes, you know how it is, If you're going in for a surgery, you have to sign a consent to treat form. That's you giving the surgeon permission to cut holes in your body in order to bring healing to your life. You sign a consent form. I think prayer is kind of like signing a consent form, only you're doing it with God. You're saying, "God, I'm giving you permission to intervene in my life. I'm giving you permission to let your will be done in my life." That's kind of what prayer is. But what if you can't consent? You know, what if you're in a horrible car accident and you're knocked unconscious and you're taken off to the hospital for emergency surgery and you can't sign the consent form? Well, there's a couple of things. One is implied consent. And I kind of wonder if maybe God doesn't do implied consent. I kind of wonder if God maybe does, I don't know. But what if instead God gives us power of attorney when a friend can't intercede for themselves? What if God gives us the ability to sign the consent form for them? As part of the human race, to come before Almighty God and say, you know what, God, we give you permission to intercede. We give you permission to break into the human story and to do things, powerful things, on behalf of this person that we're lifting up in prayer. I think maybe that's kind of how it works. But today we're not going to talk about intercessory prayer. We did that last week. Today we're going to talk about personal prayer. And there are two ways to do personal prayer as well. And Jesus tells us the story about the two ways to do personal prayer. One way is the right way, and one is not so right. Jesus describes it this way. He says, two men went up to the temple to pray. One a Pharisee, and the other a tax collector. Now, in first century times, as Jesus is telling this story, he has set it up. We'd have to tweak this story a little bit to make it fit our world today. We'd have to somehow have a category of people that most people would say those are really good people. Those are the people that really have it all together. They have it together spiritually. They have it together professionally. These people are really good people. I'll let you fill in the blank. Whoever you think would fit that box, that's a Pharisee in first century times. We tend to look at the Pharisees and think, oh yeah, those were the bad people. Well, in Jesus' day, that's not how people saw it. Pharisee was the good guy. And the other was a tax collector. Yeah. Tax collector. My dad had a Labrador Retriever puppy, and he was wanting to name his Labrador Retriever. And my dad speaks Spanish, and he thought, wouldn't it be cool for me to name my Labrador Retriever Retriever in Spanish? But what would be the Spanish word for retriever? And so he talked to a few of his friends who were much more fluent in Spanish. He says, what word would I use for a retriever, you know, for a Labrador Retriever? And his friend said, cobrador. And my dad was like, cool, okay, I'm going to name my dog Cobrador. And we called him Kobe for short. And we were in Sonora, Mexico on a mission trip. Or was it Chihuahua? I don't remember. We were on two different mission trips quite close together. But we were on a mission trip with my dad in Mexico. And my dad was talking to a man in his home. It must have been Sonora because we were in the hacienda of this rancher in Sonora. And he was talking to him about his Labrador. And he said, yeah, I call him Cobrador. And the man in Sonora was like, you mean like tax collector? Debt collector? You're calling, that's kind of a mean thing to call your dog. It was kind of the reaction that he had. And I don't know how well that word translates, but the idea was a retriever. You know, somebody goes out and gets something, brings it back to you. But my dad discovered that word had a negative connotation as well, right? Tax collector. And as Jesus tells this story, there's kind of that notion there. Right? The good guy and the bad guy. And even as you listen to the prayer, it's really important for us to understand that we have a 21st century understanding of this verse. We've heard sermons on this verse for a long time. We've had it explained to us and broken down to us many times that we know the Pharisee's a bad guy, and for some odd, strange reason, the tax collector ends up being the good guy. But Jesus' audience doesn't know this when he's telling the story. They're quite sure that the Pharisee is somebody who's on God's side, and the tax collector is on the side of the Roman government, and he's the bad guy. Jesus continues the story. The Pharisee, let me change that. There we go. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. The problem with the Pharisee is that he knows he's a good person. He stands against all the right things. He stands against political or corporate corruption. He stands against injustice. He stands against unfaithfulness. He does without for the common good. He pays his dues. He's a good person, and isn't being a good person enough? That's what the Pharisee thinks. He thinks that, after all, isn't that what life is really all about? It's about good, being a good person and doing nice things. And if you're a good person, you do nice things, and you've had a good life, and that's good. If you were to grade these two men on the curve, Pharisee and the tax collector, the Pharisee wins. He can compare himself to other people, and he can compare his score to other people's scores, and he can say, look, I win. Jesus goes on, but the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Be merciful to me. I want you to notice this appeal, this cry out to God, and the difference. By the way, there's a whole bunch in this verse, and I don't want to take too much time with it, but there's a whole bunch in this verse. The Pharisee stands, and the Greek is very interesting here because it uses passive and middle voice when it describes the posture and the practice of the Pharisee. He stands, some translations actually render this, he stands and prays to himself. Because or praise about himself. This Pharisee, you even wonder in the way the story is rendered if his prayers go any higher than the ceiling. It's quite the opposite of what you think. You think, well, this guy's a good guy. His prayers go all the way directly to heaven, and the tax collector, his prayers don't even go to the ceiling. But the Pharisee isn't even praying with the presence of God. He's praying more with the presence of himself. But the tax collector, standing far off. And it doesn't tell us standing far off from what. The Pharisee, it says, he's standing very close to himself. But the tax collector is standing far off. Far off from the Pharisee? Far off from himself? Is he detached from even himself? Or is he standing far off from God? Doesn't tell us. It just tells him that he stands far off. Wouldn't even lift up his eyes to heaven. That tells us something about some sense of distance he has and he senses between him and God. He beats himself in the chest. An expression of anguish, self-loathing, self-destructiveness. And says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. There's something powerfully packed in this word, be merciful, that's important for us to explore. So I apologize for geeking out on Greek with you, but you got to know this word. This is this Greek word, helaskomai. Helaskomai. God, helaskomai me, a sinner. And I'm going to show you a lexical definition of this word, helaskomai. Means to forgive, to make atonement for, to show mercy, to have pity. Luke 18:13. You can see what the people who made this lexicon believe this word should say. But as I dug into this word a little bit more deeply, I really got kind of hung up on that middle definition. To make atonement for, Hebrews 2:17. And I thought, well, that's kind of different. Which is it? Is it forgive? Is it to make atonement for? Is it to show mercy or have pity? Luke 18:13. The scholars have rendered their verdict and they believe that it means have mercy. And therefore that shows up in our translation this way. But then I did something more. I have this collection of these huge books. It's like a whole bunch of volumes. It's about this long on my library, all these volumes. It's Kittle's Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. Had I ever known that we'd have digital books, I would have never bought the set. It just takes up too much space. Breaks the backs of the poor souls that have to help me when I move. Sorry about that, Ted. Heavy books. But I pulled this volume out and I looked up Helasco Maya in this volume, and I found this conclusion to an entire discussion about what the word Helasco Maya meant in pagan times, in the writings of Homer, in the Old Testament Septuagint, and then in the New Testament. And this was the conclusion that they came to. The most striking thing about the development of the term or terms related to this is that words which were generally used to denote man's action in relation to God, in relation of God, cease to be used in this way in the New Testament and are used instead of God's action in relation to man. So to helaskomai, back in pagan Greek culture, would have been to go before the deity or to go before the emperor and make yourself so pitiful that the emperor, despite the fact that you deserve to be crushed and that he wants to crush you, you make yourself so pitiful that he's like, okay, you broke the law and there's absolutely no way to pay the price for the crime you did, but I'm going to forgive you anyway because you're just a pathetic mess. And so it has to do with man's action in relation to God. If you can just appease the God enough, you can get forgiven. And these scholars look at this word and they say something changes in the meaning of this word as we continue to work through history and we work through how it's used in the Old Testament, and then we finally arrive at how it's used in the New Testament. We find that it has more to do with God's action in relation to man. How so? Have mercy on me, a sinner. Helaskomai me, a sinner. It's because this is a technical term that Hebrews 2, in its context, helps us to understand. Jesus had to be made like his brothers in every respect so that he might become a merciful, there's merciful, different word by the way, and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation, helaskomai, for the sins of the people. Powerful. In other words, the only way for Jesus to be merciful, the only way for Jesus to be a faithful high priest, isn't that he just looks at you and says, you know what, man, you've really had a rough life. I'm going to let you into heaven. You know, forget all the law of God and forget the rules that are necessary to be in relationship with God. Just forget all that stuff. Just come in. No. For Jesus to be a merciful high priest, for Jesus to be a faithful high priest, there must be an appropriate sacrifice for sin to make propitiation for the sins of people, to pay the price, to substitutionary atone, I can't even say that word, for the sins of sinners, to take their place, to be a substitute for the people. So when the tax collector stands far off and doesn't lift his eyes up to heaven but beats his breast, he's actually saying, God, helaskomai, me a sinner. God, atone for my sins. Provide propitiation. He's begging for a life. He's begging for a sacrifice. He's begging for a sacrifice to be given in his place. It is in this context that Jesus then concludes the story. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified, innocent, found innocent in a court of law rather than the other. And then Jesus explains why. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. And that's how Jesus concludes the story. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Now, I think it's very important for us to take just a couple of minutes here and take a look at how Jesus begins this story and how he ends this story. I didn't even tell you how he begins the story, because if I tell you how he begins the story, it just kind of ruins the whole sermon. I always wait till the end to tell you how he begins the story in these stories, because the beginning always tells you what the parable means, and that's no fun. It's more fun to look at the story just in its own, without the narrator telling us what it means. Because Jesus' first audience probably didn't have the narrator explaining that, right? So this is the beginning. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. The story begins with an understanding that there's a problem with the Pharisee, and the problem with the Pharisee is he thinks he's perfect. He thinks he's smart. He thinks he's the one that's right and everybody else is stupid. Now, can you imagine a modern-day Pharisee? We've got a lot of them. All you got to do is go on social media, and it doesn't matter what political party they're in. It doesn't matter what church they go to or if they go to a church at all. It's something that is so deeply ingrained in human nature that being a Pharisee is the most natural, easiest thing for any human being to do. All you have to do is trust in yourself that you're right and that everybody else is stupid and wrong and contemptible. You're a Pharisee. I won't ask for a show of hands. But I know I've struggled. I struggle in that area. That's the intro. And notice the outro. Notice the ending passage here. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. And the thing I notice as I look at this language is, as I look at this language, I realize that there's a problem that is harmful to us as human beings, and that is trusting in yourself, trusting in your own goodness, trusting in your own righteousness, trusting in being right itself, treating other people with contempt. Serious problem. Just highlight those things. Trusted in themselves that they were righteous, treated other people with contempt. There's a problem with that way of being. And then there's this contrast. Instead of exalting yourself, what if you humbled yourself? Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself, Jesus says, will be exalted. So we have this tax collector standing afar off from himself, standing afar off from the Pharisee, feeling far off from God. He feels so far away, he's sure his prayers will never reach the rafters of the building. But his prayer is heard. Because he says, God, alas, go my, me a sinner. Make atonement for me, a sinner. Is there any way, despite my depravity, despite my poverty, despite the fact that I have no offering to bring to you other than my prayers, is there any way you can atone for my sins? Is there any way that you can fill the gap? Is there any way you can bridge the chasm between me and you? God's answer is really simple. The one who's telling the story is the bridge. The one who's telling the story, Jesus himself, is the atoning sacrifice. He's the one who hears the cry of the worst among us and makes atonement. And the amazing thing about the story, as we think about the story, is there's absolutely no difference between the Pharisee and the tax collector. The only difference between the two of them is the Pharisee thinks he's good, and the tax collector knows he's not. You know what they say, right? Knowing you have a problem and admitting you have a problem is the first step toward recovery. The dilemma that we have when it comes to the two ways to pray is we've got to know the truth. We often say that in Christian circles, right? You know, we believe the truth. I know the truth. I study the Bible because I know the truth. Well, there's one truth we need to know above all other truths. And the truth we need to know above all other truths is the truth about ourselves. We need to know that truth. And guess what? You know what the reality is? We all know it. The Pharisee knows it when he goes to the temple to pray. He knows he's a sinner. But he thinks he can fool God. He knows what's really going on inside, and that's why he goes and tries to justify himself. It's why we try to justify ourselves. But it's time to just be honest. It's time to be honest about the truth about ourselves, and it's time to be honest with God. Just appear in His presence. Say, God, halasko my, me. Make atonement for me. Make atonement for me, a sinner. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we come into your presence with the desire to know you. A desire to be unified with you, a desire to be connected with you. And no matter how hard we try to make it right, to bridge that gap, we cannot stretch across it. It's too big. It's too far. There's nothing good in us. Father, when we turn to the storyteller, when we turn to the one who tells the story, he's trying to hint with us. He's trying to help us understand. He's trying to help us know that our biggest problem isn't just our sin. Our biggest problem is our blindness, our inability to see it, and our honesty, our inability to admit the truth. So we come in your presence right now, and we bow our heads and we close our eyes and we just say, Lord, here I am. You know the truth. I do my best to hide it from other people. I do my best to cover it up. I try to justify myself by listing off my good deeds. But you know. Because you know, I ask you to come into my life to be that faithful priest. To be the just judge. We know you can't just wink at our sin and tell us, ah, no harm, no foul, no big deal, because there is harm and there is a foul. It costs something. And we don't know why, but for some reason, in your incredible love for us, you loved us so much that you gave your only begotten Son. That whoever comes to you with a contrite heart and says, atone for me, a sinner. You hear and you answer. And you heal and you restore. And we are grateful. In Jesus' name, amen.